Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. The latest on vitamin C, it can kill an awful lot of bacteria. Are you still eating conventional meat or poultry? What else are you eating that you're not aware of? I'll give you the lowdown on that. Then we're going to take a look at a study that finds that high doses of vitamin B complex can help prevent a very important illness. Also, GMO ingredients. They're not good. I'll give you more reasons not to eat GMOs. From our public health segment today, an important study done by Polish research scientists that show that, well, there's no historical benefit in vaccines. That's correct. I'll read you the actual conclusions. And they're saying that all these major diseases that we've had, infectious diseases, they were already gone before a vaccine was invented for them. So that'll be up today. Also, we have a lot to share. From Derek Jensen, Terrain.org, thoughts on the apocalypse. Fight for what you love. My guest in the second part of our program today, talking about biocognitive sciences, how our cultural beliefs and the environment contribute to your immunity, your aging, your longevity, even your healing. So let's get this straight. You're not determined by the genes you have. Your genes are determined by the beliefs that you have. We'll get into that. My guest is a unique person. He is Dr. Mario Martinez. He is the clinical psychologist specializing in psychoneuroimmunology and anti-aging. He developed the theory of biocognitive science and psychology, a mind-body theory that explains how thoughts and their biological expression co-merge within a cultural environment. So he's a unique person. You won't want to miss that, and I suggest you get your friends to tune in. And other commentaries, if time permits. Let's begin. I work with vitamin C a great deal. I see its power used intravenous for the serious illnesses at high doses. I've seen it work with infections from herpes to hepatitis. I've seen it save people's lives with advanced cancer and age-defining illnesses. Here's the latest, and this is from the BBC News. It says vitamin C can kill multi-drug-resistant TB in the lab. Now, according to Michelle Roberts, the health editor, the surprise discovery may point a new way of tackling this very hard-to-treat infection. And the authors from Yeshiva University say in their communication, 650,000 people worldwide have multi-drug-resistant TB. They're going to die. Nothing that they can be given in the way of pharmaceuticals works. But this could provide hope for them. And, of course, they're always going to say you need more research, but the fact is that in the laboratory, the vitamin C, quote, appeared to be acting as a reducing agent, something that triggers the production of reaction in oxygen species called free radicals. These free radicals killed off the tuberculosis, even drug-resistant forms of tuberculosis that are untreatable with conventional antibiotics, such as isoniazid. The lead investigator, Dr. William Jacobs, professor of microbiology and immunology at Albert Einstein College of Medicine at Yeshiva University, said, quote, we've only been able to demonstrate this in a test tube, and we don't know if it'll work in humans and in animals. This would be a great study to consider because we have strains of tuberculosis that we don't have drugs for. And I know that in the laboratory we can kill those strains with vitamin C. Here's my suggestion to Dr. William Jacobs. Dr. Jacobs, there's the laboratory academic setting. Then there's the real world, where people suffer from tuberculosis, mainly in third world countries. Then there is the first world clinical environment where there are thousands of physicians working every day helping people who've had MRSA-resistant infections become well again using intravenous vitamin C. More than 3,000 patients were treated at the Tri-State Healing Center by some 24 physicians and healing assistants, and almost all of them had very serious illnesses. Vitamin C intravenous was the key, but not just vitamin C, quercetin for the bioflavonoids, glutathione, and vitamin A. So my suggestion, get out of the university, get out of the laboratory, get away from the Petri dish, and spend some time working with the clinicians. Then you'll see what's possible. Otherwise, it'll be 10 years and 10 more studies before someone actually figures out maybe this is a good idea. That's part of the problem with the monotheistic values within Orthodox science. Now, a lot of people are into eating meat. The majority of Americans eat meat, and they eat meat several times a day. And no matter what we say in the vegetarian movement, or then in the vegan movement, and then in the healthy vegan movement, which is probably less than one half of 1% of the population, we can't change the minds of people by example or by any of our informed input. To the contrary, there was a time when people ate meat, but they generally ate a healthier type of meat. They were grass-fed, not feedlot-fed, and they traveled long distances on the prairie, so they were lean. They did not have the antibiotics given. Antibiotics hadn't been invented then. They didn't have any growth-stimulating hormones, and they weren't eating genetically engineered soy or corn. So they generally ate small portions. Where I was growing up, unless you were from an Italian family, everyone knew, and they were friends of mine, close friends, so I was in their house every day, and I saw the portion sizes, and of course all the daughters were all fat, and the parents were all fat. In fact, everyone that was fat, and I just noticed it, and I noticed how much they ate, and then I noticed how much we ate, and all my friends ate, and we were all wiry and strong, but we ate small portions, and so the portion size was significant. We also were not allowed to have anything that might be considered a junk food unless it was on the weekend. Otherwise, during the week, you ate your meals and with your family. Not today. Today, we've gone just in the opposite direction. Not only are we eating more meat than ever before, we're eating larger portions at a given meal. The new emphasis is super, super, super sized protein, where you'll get beef patties and then bacon and then eggs, all and with cheese and huge buns and sometimes double burgers. And one restaurant that was advertised recently in a television show has 4-pound hamburgers. Well, that's more than what the stomach can hold. So imagine what that's doing. That's giving you 1 week's worth of protein in one single item of food at one day. That's killing your liver, your kidneys. That's clogging your artery. It's hurting your heart, your brain. It's producing massive chemical reactions. Living a short life. But here's what you should know. Let's say that when you sit down to eat the ribs or the fried chicken or whatever you're eating, a television screen popped up on the counter. And then an announcer would say, "Hope you're enjoying your meal. I just want to let you know what you're getting." And then I would scroll down and show them what Natasha Longo had written. And here's what she says, quote, 70% of all beef and chicken sold in the United States, Canada, United Kingdom, and Australia contain a growing number of preservatives, meat glues, antibacterial, antifungal, and antiviral sprays. They also are commonly treated with carbon monoxide gas injections to make the meat appear more fresh than it actually is. Synthetic preservatives are added to 70% of all factory farm meat and poultry to prevent spoilage, rancidity, and mold growth. Sodium benzoate, sodium propionate, and benzoic acid. That's right, they have all been added to the meat that you eat. And then it goes on to talk about the nitrites. And the nitrites and are what keep the meat looking redder. And they prohibit some bacterial growth. Nitrites may be added directly to the meat. Well, how much? How often? Who does it? Well, that's not important. We're not told. They're added to make pork, beef, and poultry stay more of a natural color. Otherwise, they would turn to a putrid gray. For example, nitrites are added to ham and bacon, giving them their characteristic pink color. Now, some countries even permit the use of nitrites in fish products. Well, when you combine nitrites with certain amino acids, you end up with a N-nitroso compound. And that, these nitrosamines, are formed and they are known cancer-causing agents. And so we get them in our food. Now then you have the sulfites. And the sulfites are used as a preservative to maintain food coloring and prolong shelf life. That's why when you go into some restaurants in the morning, you'll see people working diligently to make all of the salads and all the vegetables. And you're thinking, well, hold on, when are you going to sell that? And someone says, oh, about 12 hours now. Well, that's going to wilt or turn. No, it won't. We've used these chemicals, the sulfites. I see. But don't the sulfites or their byproducts like potassium, bisulfite, and sodium bisulfite, and sulfur dioxide, aren't those all from sulfuric acids? And aren't those known allergens? Aren't they known carcinogens? Yeah. But at least your vegetable looks like it's fresher than what it is. And then they use meat glue. What's that? Well, it's produced by the Activa by Japan, a company, and it's called a transglutamase. And it's a clotting enzyme. And meat glue is thrombin, a coagulation protein which, together with fibrous protein fibrin, can be used to develop a meat glue enzyme that can be used for sticking pieces of different pieces of meat together. Generally, the worst parts of cows or pigs are brought together with this glue, and then all meshed up, and then it all kinds of sticks together and you don't see it. That doesn't sound good, does it? No, it doesn't. Unless you specifically ask for it, give me some meat glue. I want to glue as many bad pieces, the pig's ear, you know, the testicle skin of a cow. I want that all put together. You can do that, can't you? Sure. Then they put viral sprays. Can't wait to get that. I'd like to show them manufacturing the viral sprays, much like manufacturing a vaccine. So the FDA has approved the virus cocktail spray, and that's supposed to prevent listeriosis. It's called LMP-102. It's a mixture of six different special viruses. But do you want that in your body? I don't think so. And you also get the bacteriophages, and those are going to have all kinds of battles in your stomach with your normal bacteria. Then you get carbon monoxide treatment. Carbon monoxide, you know, when people go in the garage, leave the car running and kill themselves? That's carbon monoxide. It's colorless, it's odorless, it's tasteless, it's a gas. And you don't want to inhale it. But they put it on the meat because it sticks to hemoglobin, a molecule in blood that usually carries oxygen, even better than oxygen can. When people are exposed to higher levels of carbon monoxide, the gas takes the place of oxygen in the bloodstream and wreaks havoc. You end up confused, headaches, tiredness, unconsciousness, and death. Just imagine. Imagine if we get so creative or get so jaded that producers, and only when they've had all the cocaine they can actually use about 2.5 bowls full per day, decide, let's do a new reality show. Let's have people who are very aggressive but also very depressed. There's Wall Street and lawyers, politicians. Go into a restaurant and give them a complete grand buffet of all the food they can eat. But the idea is at the end of the meal, they have so much carbon monoxide, they die. And then we process them, you know, with the glue and everything else for the next batch. And then see if you can guess who you're eating. What a show. What do you think the ratings for that would be? Probably about the same as WrestleMania or one of the violent shows. Think there'd be an audience for it? You bet. And so that's what you're getting when you're eating your meat. Yeah. High doses of vitamin complex. Wouldn't it be interesting if animals, if we actually had to watch an animal through its entire lifespan before you ate it, including the slaughter? There is no such thing as a humane slaughter. That's an oxymoron. How we deceive ourselves with words. High doses of the B complex can help prevent what? Alzheimer's. This is a new major study published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. And to reach the conclusion the researchers gave, elderly people with mild cognitive impairment, the stage before dementia or Alzheimer's, a combination of vitamin B1, half of what I would have suggested, they're giving 500 micrograms, I'd give a 1 milligram. 20 milligrams of B6, I'd have given 200. And folic acid versus a placebo for 2 years. I'd have given at least 500 milligrams of folic acid. So the subjects received, or micrograms, excuse me, the subjects received the B vitamins showed significantly less brain degeneration than the placebo group. In fact, disease shrinks 8 times. Lead researcher David Smith of Oxford University, quote, in those with high homocysteine levels, that's a bad inflammatory marker, the specific areas of the brain associated with Alzheimer's shrank 8 times more slowly in those taking the B complex than those taking a placebo. Quote, this is strongly indicative that the B vitamins may be substantially slowing down or even potentially arresting the disease process in those with early stage cognitive decline. This is the first treatment that has been shown to potentially arrest Alzheimer's-related brain shrinkage, end quote. Well, that's good. So get your B-complex, but get it at higher doses than what they're suggesting for optimal benefits. And finally, a study linking chemicals widely found in processed foods to be elevating our blood pressure in children and teens. This is from New York University School of Medicine. It says, nearly 3,000 children show dietary exposure to certain plastics may play a hidden role in an epidemic in childhood hypertension. Now, we know that these plastic additives, these are the phthalates, are odorless, colorless, and just about everywhere. They turn up in flooring, plastic cups, beach balls, plastic wrap, tubing, and according to the CDC, the bodies of most Americans, because they're in so many plastic things we use, especially water bottles. Remember, in hot weather, that water bottle gets hot, then the phytates can leach into the water, and then you drink them, and then they're in your body. According to research published in the Journal of Pediatrics, certain types of phytates can pose another risk to children. It can compromise their heart health. And drawing on the data from the nationally represented survey of nearly 3,000 children and teens, researchers, in collaboration with the University of Washington and Penn State School of Medicine, documented for the first time a connection between dietary exposure to these phytates, commonly used in all this produced product and elevated systolic blood pressure. And by the way, that's a measure of pressure in the arteries when the heart contracts. And these phytates can inhibit the function of cardiac cells and cause oxidative stress that compromises the health of arteries. So, if you want to have children having healthier hearts, lower blood pressure, then don't give them everything from plastic. Really be conscious of the green products that you use and purchase. It can make all the difference in your child's health. And before we go to our break from our public health segment, this is from Heidi Stevenson from Green Med Info, and it says, quote, "The evidence continues to mount. Vaccines are doing a great deal of harm. Worse, though, the evidence that vaccines have little or no effect on infectious disease is clear, as documented by a series of graphs. The precautionary principle, which is enshrined in a UN directive, should have been implemented before vaccines were ever routinely injected." The article's in, the title of the article, Vaccines Do Irreparable Harm, study from Poland, documents all the scientists that they used in this study showed that these vaccines weren't doing the job. Plus, they cause neurological damage, whether it's from mercury, which has taken the place of a natural preservative, or after mercury was lessened in most vaccines, eliminated in some, but kept in the flu vaccine, aluminum. And now aluminum is in all the vaccines. And now that they have more vaccines, you're getting more aluminum. And it is taking over, causing all forms of damage. Quote, "From the 1990s, new vaccines for infants containing thimerosal, that's mercury, began to be used in America. In the DPT, the Hib, hepatitis B vaccines, children received doses of 62.5 UG of mercury, which is 12,000% more than the dose considered safe. These reports were the reason that Scandinavian countries already prohibited the use of mercury in 1990. The deaths of 19 infants of sudden infant death syndrome shortly after vaccination with two hexavalent vaccines was also highlighted in here. And then it went to its conclusions, quote, "The weight of the evidence, quote, collectively suggests that personal and environmental hygiene reduces the spread of infection. Thus, results from this review demonstrate that there is a continued, measurable, positive effect of personal and community hygiene on infections." So, they don't give any of the credit to the famous vaccines. They give it all to cleaner water, pasteurization, more fruits and vegetables, sanitation. That's what they say, not vaccines. And yet vaccines get all the credit. Didn't deserve it. I'm Gary Nall. We're going to take a break in just a minute here. Just wanted to share this with you. By the way, for those of you who are listening over the telephone, you're a whole bunch of people listening because you can hear this show just on your telephone anywhere. 619-550-0869. 619-550-0869 to listen. I received an email from a person who said that they like the good information on the show, but I should stop giving any information that makes people feel desperate or helpless. To the contrary, if all you do is listen to feel-good, positive information, then how are we supposed to even recognize the problems and therefore approach them in a reasonable and responsible way? According to Derek Jensen, and I certainly concur, that the dominant culture is murdering the planet. And there really isn't a prayer for stopping this murder so long as so many people continue to value this culture over life on the planet. The life it is murdering. This valuing is almost universal in this culture. Even most mainstream environmentalists say explicitly that they're attempting to save civilization, but they exclude it's not the real world. For example, even someone as dedicated as Bill McKibben regularly states he wants to stop global warming to save civilization. And even someone equally dedicated like Peter Montague, who puts out the invaluable Rachel newsletter on toxics, said that pumping carbon underground for storage is a bad idea because if it leaked out all at once, it could, to use his words, quote, disrupt civilization as we know it. No, Peter, it could end life on Earth. Here's another example of this valuing. What do most mainstream solutions to global warming have in common? They all take industrial civilization as a given. Preserve industrial civilization. Let us not stop industrial civilization. Let us not stop or slow down the engine of economic growth. Let's just make it manageable. Nonsense. And what happens with the natural world? What happens when we must confront the natural world in relationship to the industrialized civilization? That is literally insane in terms of being out of touch with physical reality, and it will never work and never has. When I talk about anything that is of a negative nature concerning the environment, like solar storms or the Oklahoma tornado, I don't mean simply the end of life as we know it, by which we is clearly meant the end of this culture. What I mean when I talk about this is the death of the planet. I mean the death of the salmon. I mean the death of the oceans. I mean the extirpation of 200 species per day. I mean 99% of all native forest already having been murdered, and 99% of native grasslands, and so on. I mean one quarter of all rivers no longer reaching the ocean. I mean oysters experiencing reproductive failure, which is, in science speak, for their babies all dying in the ocean off the North Pacific area. I mean dead zones all through the oceans. I mean the collapse of migratory songbird populations. I mean the collapse of insect populations. I mean the collapse of bat populations. I mean the death of the real world. How do you avoid seeing what is right in front of your eyes? Well, that's easy. We simply spend more of our energy attempting to avoid facing the severity of the problems this culture is the cause of. We are the cause of the death of this planet. And that means they are not solving these problems. Even when life as we know it, haven't we heard that many times? Life as we know it is what's killing the planet. Far too many people, including far too many mainstream environmentalists, perceive the end of this culture as the real apocalypse. The real world doesn't even enter the picture. So it's no wonder the real world continues to be killed. It's not nearly so important to most of the beneficiaries of this way of life as those benefits they gain from planetary murder. One of the ways we avoid looking at the problems is by pretending that those we are killing don't really exist. For example, when I say this culture is killing the planet, I don't mean it's causing, as too many people put it, the irreparable breakdown of the Earth's systems. This is because I don't believe the Earth has systems. That is machine language. That is Descartes language. That is reductionistic language. That is bone stupid. I believe the Earth has communities. The world consists of subjects whose lives are as beautiful and precious to them as our own life is to you and to me. And these subjects live in communities as complex and vibrant as those communities with which you and I are surrounded. This understanding is crucial because the language we use not only reflects but influences how we perceive and experience the world, and how we perceive and experience the world influences how we behave in the world. And our current behavior is abysmal, including the environmentalists, including so many so-called conscientious activists, including so many of the so-called, you know, people who care about what goes down against the multinationals, globalization. All right? But you're smoking their cigarettes. You're using their credit cards. You're banking with them. You're taking out their student loans. You're eating their food. You're watching their television. Did I miss something? You're a part of their culture. And it's their culture and your culture that's killing the world. Look at how we disengage our emotions from the semantics of the language that pretends not to be based upon our reality. Another way we avoid looking at the severity of the problems is by pretending that the murder of the planet isn't really the murder of the planet, but just the death of the planet as we know it. Really? How trite. That language only serves to abstract us from the horrors. 90% of the large fish in the oceans are dead. There is more plastic in the oceans than phytoplankton in the oceans. Now reflect on this. The oceans are being killed. The oceans. Look at it this way. If a person you really love is dying from being poisoned, like the rivers are poisoned, the oceans are poisoned, our soils poisoned, or from being skinned alive, or if someone you love is being tortured to death, and picture your parent or your child or your lover, your sibling or your best friend, would you say this person is dying as we know it? Of course not. When it comes to the real world, the world that is the source of all life, this is precisely the attitude taken by even too many environmentalists. And if you doubt me, watch the excoriating lecture I gave to an entire room on Earth Day at the UN as the keynote speaker, where I condemned 99.9% of the entire environmental corporate movement in this country, because all they were there to do is to give lip service to what they were not effectively willing to sacrifice anything meaningful to change, the earth. Sometimes at talks, people ask me, oh, the world isn't being killed, it's just being transformed. Where'd you learn that? Your yoga class? Yeah. Good for you. That's merely another lie people tell themselves to maintain their distance. Merely another way people can justify their lack of sufficient action in the face of planetary murder. Whenever people say this, I always ask if they have a knife I can borrow. Someone in the audience gives a knife. I walk up to the questioner and ask him. It's almost always a male to extend his hand. He doesn't want to. I insist. I take his hand in mine. I hold the knife over the base of his hand or finger. I don't cut it or even make the remotest gesture to it. But I say, let's pretend I'm going to start cutting you. I'm not going to kill you. I'm just going to transform you. I'm going to cut off this finger. And then this finger, and then this thumb, and then I'll start with your toes, and then move up to your hands and feet and arms and your legs. But don't worry, I won't kill you. At some point, your heart will stop beating. But that's not all the big deal. It's not like I'm going to torture you to death or anything. It will merely be the end of your life as you know it, a transformation. Yunky dunky. Picture this. You're sitting somewhere with a friend and suddenly you hear screaming and realize your lover is being tortured in the next room. You leap up, say to your friend, "My lover is being tortured and killed. We need to stop this." Your friend sits on his chair and, puffing contemplatively on his pipe, responds, "Does this mean the death of your lover or just the death of your lover as you know your lover?" So you sit right back down and say, "Damn, good point. Charlie, I can always count on you to help me stay rational. Thank you, Charlie." A philosophical conversation ensues, one that is so interesting that after a while, you no longer hear the screams. Most people don't hear the earth scream. They don't hear the animals scream. We don't hear any screaming. It disturbs us. Only say good things. Never make us hear screams. And so we don't. Or sometimes I'm asked, what gives me hope? And the answer is that I don't believe in hope. I don't. Hope is a longing for a future condition over which we have no agency. That's how we use the word in everyday life. I don't hope I eat something in a few moments. I don't hope I eat the right food today. I don't hope that my body is better today than yesterday. No, I just do things that cause it to happen, or more likely, give me the outcome I want. On the other hand, the next time I get on a plane, I hope it doesn't crash, but once it's in the air, I have no agency. So when people say they hope the coho salmon survive, they're saying that they have no agency. I'm not interested in hope. I'm interested in doing what needs to be done now. No, if you love the salmon, if you love the lampreys, if you love the forest, if you love the oceans, if you love the bears, you love the birds, if you're in love, you act to defend your beloved. If your beloved is threatened and you don't do whatever it takes to defend your beloved, then what you're feeling isn't love. If you love the Constitution, if you love the freedom that our founding fathers gave us, if you love the sacrifices others have made before you, then defend them. Otherwise, you don't really love them. And we've had decades of watching everything that we should love, from our rights and our freedoms, completely eroded. Someone asked me, do you mean I can't hope that my brother who has cancer survives? And I said, of course you can hope your brother survives. Some of that is out of your control. But why don't you and your brother do all that you can with what we know that can go beyond hope? What? Look at all the people who went one step beyond hope and engaged in the best of total body-mind medicine, and today are alive and well because they engaged the full force and the full power that they have. The world is being murdered. Industrial civilization is causing this. The corporate, liberal, and conservative civilization is responsible. This is not cognitively challenging. We need to stop this culture from killing the planet. The planet is more important than this culture. It is more important than any culture. It is by definition, because without a planet, you don't have any culture at all. We need to fight for what we love. Fight harder than you've ever thought you could fight. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Everyone, I'm Gary Noll. We're going to go to our guest in a few moments, who is standing by, Dr. Mario Martinez, and talk about biocognitive sciences, how our cultural beliefs and environment contribute to immunity, aging, and longevity, and wounding and healing. But before we do that, I'm just going to take a few moments for an announcement about an upcoming event that I think will help transform a lot of people. Joining me online is Luann Panessi. Hi, Luann. Oh, she's just in the studio. The second week of July, starting on Sunday the 7th and going for 1 or 2 weeks, it's actually 2 weeks long, but you can come for just 1 week, will be what I believe will be the most unique retreat I've ever done. I've done over 400. Some of you used to come at the Catskills. Those of you who were up at the Catskills and in the Homowack and the Neverly and Grossinger's and the Concord, those of you who join me on the QE2, 2,300 people on the about 4 years ago on the other cruise that went down through the Caribbean, that was about 1,500 people. And then a different up in the Catskills on the farm, New Jersey on Lake Bacong, down in Texas and in Tioga. This is going to exceed all those. Here's what you can expect. First and foremost, I've combined five concepts into one retreat. I looked all over America for a place to do a retreat that would be absolutely unique, that would bring people to nature in a way that was unadulterated, that was pure, intimate, and pristine. After 2 years of looking, I found that location in the beautiful hill country with lakes. It is pristine. The water is millions of years old. It's the healing water. It's a yoga retreat with one of the greatest yoga teachers in America, a teacher who teaches other teachers to be certified. Different yoga from beginning to advanced every day. From there, personal training in a state-of-the-art gym. From there, water aerobics or just enjoying the deep mineral pools. From there, the finest healing breakfasts of juices and smoothies. 2 hours of workshop every morning, a cooking class on gourmet vegan cooking, hands-on. From there, a lunch, exquisite vegan and also gluten-free lunches. After that, meditation classes, Qigong and other meditations by master meditator. After that, an afternoon two-hour cooking class. 2 hours of cooking with raw foods, or I should say preparing raw foods of every type, including presentation, salads, soups, entrees. After that, the late afternoon, early evening yoga class. After that, all kinds of time to sit with nature in one of the most beautiful environments I've ever seen. It doesn't look like it belongs in America. It looks like it belongs in Italy because it's a beautiful villa that was built in the 1930s with artisans from Italy, marble gardens and fountains. It's just exquisite. So there's plenty of places for quiet meditation and reflection. Then there is dinner, gorgeous dinner with the chefs, the master chefs. And then after that, I do a lecture, a different one every night. Throughout the day, if people would like some counseling on issues, Luen Panessi will be there. So, and I'm there the entire 2 weeks. You can come 1 or 2 weeks. Now, this is a fundraiser for this radio station. The entire cost, that includes a beautiful hotel with two queen beds and a suite, it's only 5 miles away, is $2,000 for the first week. But if you stay the second week, the price goes down the second week to $1,500. There's no tipping. There's no extra unless you get massage. But outside of that, everything is included from the time you reach the hotel, including your hotel, is paid for, all for $2,000. There will be more workshops and more counseling, the more yoga, meditation, cooking, de-stressing, detoxing, and rejuvenation. Those are the themes. Never done all this before. I've had cooking retreats. I've had yoga retreats. I've had detox and de-stress retreats. I've never had them all. You can take as many or as few classes in a day as you want. So this is the only time I'm doing this. My schedule doesn't permit me to do it. And I look around, and I wanted a place that was different. I went out to Sedona. I went to Boulder. I went all over the place, Northern California, looking for the right environment. I wanted an environment where the environment itself is part of the healing process. And I found it, but it wasn't available for over a year. So I have it for 2 weeks, starting right after the 4th of July weekend, so that then the fares go down. It's cheap tickets, easy to get to. So that's it. Luann, and our number to call in if you'd like to join us, and going to be some great stuff. I put together the finest teachers in cooking, yoga, meditation, transformational processes that I could find in the United States for this. I haven't done a retreat in a year and a half, and this is going to be it for the year. So I want to put it all together. What a great way a person could spend 1 or 2 weeks. Call 877-627-5065. It is limited. One of the ways you make something special is you have just the right amount of people so everyone can get personal attention, everyone. Nothing feels cluttered, and everything feels close to nature, and you don't get any closer to nature. There's a beautiful Emerald Lake right on the property. private to just this, to meditate over. And yoga is done in a beautiful, I've never seen anything like this, a beautiful yoga villa right on the lake, all screened. You look out, you see the white swans, or five white swans I saw there when I visited recently. So there's just nothing like this. Call 877-627-5065, 877-627-5065. Give yourself an opportunity to detoxify, rejuvenate, de-stress, learn cooking, but really learn it. You know, if you do 4 hours a day, every day for 2 weeks, you're really learning it. If you do yoga with a master yoga teacher every day, twice a day, for 2 weeks, you're really learning it. This isn't superficial. Deep relaxation, qigong, healing, so you can learn how to move that healing energy around your body. And juices all day and all evening in a beautiful cabana that you can sit in the shade and have delicious iced tea, lemonade, juices of all types all day. Everything is included, $2,000. That's it for the first week, $1,500 second. Absolutely give yourself this gift. 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065. This is a fundraiser for this non-commercial radio station. Luann, your thoughts?
Well, Gary, leave it to you to outdo yourself. This is just an amazing package that you're offering to people. And, you know, a lot of people that email me, because people do email me and ask me questions, and I often answer them, and then, of course, you know, I bring them to the air. So many people say, you know, I hear all this information, I want to do what's right, but I'm surrounded by people that are dysfunctional, and I want to kind of do what everybody else is doing. I need time alone to learn this stuff and do hands-on, practical application of this magnificent information that they're hearing on the show. And this is just about the best way you could do it. You're in the most pristine, beautiful environment, and you're surrounded by nature, by birds, and it's just magnificent. I wish I could come up with a better word for it, but the energy is just is amazing. And when you see all the things that you're going to be getting, one of the most important things that you talk to people about is to reconnect with their true self, with the real you. That was a big one for me because I was coming from a very conditioned environment. I was a nurse administrator. I was in corporate America and looking for the bottom line. And when I spent the first week, as you know, in Tioga, Texas, the first time you had a retreat back in the 90s. And it was the first week that I realized that I was living somebody else's agenda for me and constantly striving to get their recognition for it. And that made me stay the second week because that's when I said, well, now that I know who I'm not, who the heck am I? And it was that second week that I reconnected with my true self. And when I left, I went home with a whole new set of tools to work with, not just things that I wrote down, but things that I've been able to practice. So you've got an opportunity. Everybody has an opportunity to go to this magnificent environment and actually experience a healthy lifestyle. And you'll have all the people and all the tools that you need.
I ask seven of the instructors, all of whom are the top of their field, to go and visit this. I paid to have them go in. I just wanted to get their feedback. You went down there for a day to look around. What did you think?
Oh, breathtaking is all I could really come up with.
Have you ever seen any place like this in America?
I have never. I have, and I've traveled a lot.
I've never seen a place this beautiful in my life. So this is unusual. I was given a heads up about this, and thank goodness I found it. So this is our retreat for now, and this is a fundraiser for this non-commercial station. I'm going to be there the entire time. Luann, you're going to be there the entire time.
I will.
And we have artists who are going to be there doing, I forgot, Art is Healing are going to be there. In fact, they're going in 2 weeks in advance to set up their whole living environment. So this is going to be exciting. So you don't want to miss this. And again, it's limited. and it's really inexpensive compared to what anyone else out there would offer you. This is frequently half the price, and it's everything is included except massage. You don't have to have massage, but I have to get a local masseuse if you want one. And again, I don't get a penny from that, but everything else is included. So the yoga class, the cooking, gourmet cooking class, the raw food classes, the meditation classes, the artist therapy classes, the lectures, the counseling, all included. Plus being this close to one of the most beautiful single natural settings you've ever seen in your life. So give a call. It starts the week after the 4th of July. It starts on Sunday, just orientation. The actual class starts the following Monday on the 8th, but the 7th of July. Call 619-550-0869. 619-550-0869. Thank you, Luann. Now we're going to go over and say hello to my guest, who is standing by. And I'm going to ask my engineer to let them know that I'm going to run just a little bit over into Utrice Leach's program, because I want to get him to give us some very important insights, at least get us started today on understanding the very valuable work that he's engaged in. I've given you his bio earlier in the program. He is the author of The Mind-Body Code, How the Mind Wounds and Heals the Body. It's part of his theory emerging from having been a primary science investigator into the phenomena of stigmata cases and spontaneous healing for the Catholic Church. And his website is biocognitive.com. Nice to have you with us today.
Well, thanks for inviting me, Gary. How are you?
Good. Let's begin by defining the concept, if you would please, of biocognitive therapy and theory, and explain what it means when you say that cognition and biology co-merge within a cultural history, and what are some of the ways that science shows us how our cultural history and our belief history impact positively or negatively on our genetics?
My formal training was in clinical neuropsychology, and what we studied was the sick brain, the brain with damage, and then conclusions were made of what the brain can and cannot do, but it was based on deficits rather than on the assets of the brain. And also the studies were done and the research was done excluding cultural context, and I'll explain that in a second. But what happened is that biology really borrowed the model of Newtonian physics, which is reductionistic, and it works very well with cars and planets, but it doesn't work well with living systems. So then the concepts were borrowed, and one of the concepts is entropy, which means that we go from order to disorder, and then we impose that on a living being, and we come up with conclusions like as you grow older, you're going to deteriorate. As you grow older, you'll get sick. So that's what I learned. And then as I started looking at other cultures and started looking at the good science that's going on right now, like a cultural neuroscience and psychoneuroimmunology of studying how thoughts and emotions affect the immune system, I began to see that it was a very ethnocentric, very reductionistic way of looking at human beings. Then I started studying the centenarians, people who live over 100 all over the world, and found that they were not following the patterns that were taught in gerontology. I've heard some physicians say that if you live long enough, eventually you'll die of cancer, and that's not science, that's just predictions. So I started at first thinking that centenarians were basically endowed with genetics, and that's what it was. So you have good genes or have bad genes. And as I went deeper into five continents, in Africa, Asia, United States, and so forth, I found that really the component that has to do with genetics is about only 35%. The rest is the environmental and the consciousness of the culture that allows the person to give the wisdom that they've accumulated for all those years beyond 65. Neuropsychologically, we know now, for example, that people are most mature in their intelligence and their knowledge from 65 to 85. But what do? We put people away at 65 because it's a cultural portal that tells us at this age you have to retire. And what would be an example of culture? We think that that medicine is an antibiotic is an antibiotic, and an injection is an injection. Well, when you look at cultures, you could, for example, from the mechanical point of view, if you have a leak in your gas tank, what you do is you fix the leak whether you're in Paris or in the Amazon. But with a human being, let's say you are an American of European ancestry living in New York, and you have what would be diagnosed as pernicious anemia, a deficiency in B12 vitamin. Well, then you're given the B12 vitamins and you're treated. But if that same symptom, if that same set of symptoms is diagnosed by a Aymara shaman in the Bolivian Andes, they call it limpu. And limpu is a disease or an illness or a malady that comes from watching a newborn, and that newborn spirit goes into your body, and you die. There's no, the diagnosis is completely terminal. The mestizos and the Indians will die if they have that diagnosis from a shaman, but not the white Bolivians who live in that area. So your body and your biology are responding to the cultural beliefs that you learn from day one. And that is the type of medicine and the type of health sciences that needs to be taught, that our cultures have tremendous power in creating placebo as well as nocebo. When they give you a sentence and they tell you, well, you have 6 months to live, what they study is the average people or the average patients with that kind of illness will last 6 months. They don't look at the two sides of the tail of the person or the groups that live 6 days and the ones that live 6 years. The ones who live 6 days, that you can learn the causes of illness, and the ones who live 6 years, you could learn the causes of health.
Well said. Thank you. You believe that our cultural beliefs shape our health more than our genes. As you just mentioned, there seems to be a strong similarity between biocognition and epigenetics. Yet rather than the emphasis being on chemical or substance exogenic factors from the outside environment that alter our DNA, you're looking more at the interface between our culture and our subconscious mind that can have a profound impact upon our health. How do you account for the ability of inherited beliefs or the energy of a particular cultural environment to alter our genetic programming or to alternatively to strengthen immunity and resilience to disease? And what are your main objections to conventional medicine and its genetic theories, including the one that Angelique Jolie just used to justify mutilation of her breast to prevent a disease that there's no hard proof would have happened had she not done that?
No, that's right, because what they found was a mutation in the gene that when it does, it has a probability of becoming cancerous. But you see, that gene only covers 10% of the cancers. So it's really preventive medicine as a new marketing scheme, unfortunately. But getting back to what you were asking, the epigenetics and the cultures, epigenetics really is a proven science and part of biology that actually our environment and our beliefs can change genes expression for the next generation. It's been done with rats, and it's been shown with human beings. But the other thing about culture is that our culture follows the cultural beliefs, the cultural perception. An example, in Peru, women who have menopause, the symptom of the hot flash is called bochorno, which is the word for shame in Spanish. And we know that the immune system, and by the way, I have a new way of looking at the immune system. The immune system basically confirms the consciousness that we live in. It's a lot more than just a protector. But those women believe that hot flashes are called bochorno, or shame. And even when they write scientific papers, the doctors will, or the researchers will say, and she was experiencing the shames. We know from the immune system now that shame causes inflammation. It increases interleukins 2 and other kinds of molecules that cause inflammation. So what happens? Women in Peru will have high levels of inflammation during their menopause, especially when they're having the symptoms of hot flashes. But when you go to another culture and you get away from that ethnocentric universality, then you find that in Japan, for example, the menopause is considered a second spring. an opportunity for women to move into a portal of wisdom. And when you look at their levels of inflammation, they're significantly lower than the women in Peru. So what is medicine? Medicine is culture. If you have a, for example, a migraine, the diagnosis would be based on a cause of vascular issues. But if you go to France, it's hepatic, it's the liver. And if you go to UK, it's considered gastrointestinal. So medicine, religion, psychology have a culture component that is inseparable from the reality that we create in that science.
How much science, therefore, supports the idea that illnesses are learned and that the fundamental cause of health are, in fact, inherited not just from our genes but from our environment, even in utero and post-utero?
No, of course. Well, there's support in different areas, in for example, in cultural neuroscience, in cultural anthropology, but there's no concise information going to the public and saying, we have evidence that this is how it works. So one of the evidence, I think, is that we're basically born. There's a very, very small percentage of gene mutations and errors in the expression of chromosomes and genes. When you're born, you have the best egg and the best sperm, and you have a propensity to stay in health. Then environmentally, emotionally, and then every other way, we learn to get sick. And then let me give you a quick example. We think, and the conventional medicine thinks, and psychology thinks, that what's getting sick is the body, and psychology thinks what's getting sick is the mind, without realizing that the whole system, the endocrine system, the immune system, and the nervous system, are also learning how to get sick. So an example would be fibromyalgia. Fibromyalgia is now epidemic. Now it's the thing to have. And there are two camps, one that says that it doesn't exist, and they'll send you to a psychiatrist, and the other one says that it does exist, but you can't cure it. Well, they're both wrong. It exists, and it can be cured. But how do you learn fibromyalgia? Well, it has to do with the deprivation of a type of sleep, delta sleep, where actually the immune system makes the repair, and you have the human growth hormones creating protein and so forth. A little girl will learn, because of her grandfather coming into the room and doing inappropriate things to her, that she has to sleep very light. She has to be hyper-alarmed. And it's functional for her to not sleep well. And she learns that. It has a function, it has a conservation function. But 10 years later, she's still doing that. Grandfather's not there anymore. And what has happened? She taught an immune system to suppress, because hyper-alarm causes the cortisol from the endocrine system, and it makes the immune system work less efficient. Hyperalarm secretes neurotransmitters that cause chronic pain eventually. So what happens then? She develops fibromyalgia, and she's treated with medication to help her sleep, with medication to reduce the inflammation, with medication for the pain, without realizing that there was a learning process that went on there, neuroimmunoendocrinological, that can be changed, actually. That can be changed by what the person does with their life. And what we do with fibromyalgia, we teach people how to work through the process of what they learn and reteach the nervous, immune, and endocrine system to function without hyperalarm, because the grandfather's not there anymore. But unfortunately, when you learn that kind of language, what happens is that you speak that language of what I call intimate language of love, and you will look for people that keep you hyper-alarmed, and you will look for spouses and companions that keep you hyper-alarmed, because that's the only language you know, and it perpetuates the learning.
We don't have time today, but I'm inviting you back for an extended part two, where we get into the unselfing, the principle that refers to the ability to detach ourselves from the social and cultural labels that we attached to ourselves. So we're very fond of labels in this country, so we will talk with you in depth on our next program, and we very much
look
forward
to
that.
And I want to thank you for the work you're doing, Gary.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
Okay.
Mario, soon to be back with us for an in-depth, possibly, in fact, I'm going to ask Richard Gell to have him on for the entire hour for a conversation with Remarkable Mind. Dr. Mario Martinez, the author of The Mind Body Code, the website biocognitive.com. I'm Gary Nall, and I want to thank you all for listening. Now let's say hello to Utrice Leeds, starting a little late today. Hi, Utrice.
That was quite interesting. Hello, Gary. Today, believe it or not, it is Open Forum Day.
Excellent.
And listeners call it as they see it today.
Great. We look forward to it. Utrice
Thank
Leeds
you.
Right now.
Change, change, change.